This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Human civilization has long been relentless in its pursuit of the control of nature, and particularly water. By taming the Earth's rivers, we found ways to harness their power to move commerce, and to support and advance agriculture, and provide drinking water for massive populations. In the United States, about $220 billion in commerce travels on our waterways annually, including 60% of all farm exports, and two-thirds of Americans get their drinking water from rivers and streams. Right here in Illinois, the Mississippi, Ohio, and Illinois rivers are the arteries in America's vascular system, providing the lifeblood of our economy and our society. But the infrastructure of our waterways, the dams, the levees, they're deteriorating, and the rising waters caused by climate change are only exacerbating the strain on the system, compromising our ability to control and harness the water. Our next guest spent 2 years traveling America's heartland, including here in Illinois, and the result is a book about America's rivers and the people who tame them and are tamed by them. Tyler Kelly is a journalist and author. The book is Holding Back the River, The Struggle Against Nature on America's Waterways. Hello, Tyler. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello, Ryan. Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, we want to invite you to join our conversation. The lines are open. 800-222-9455 is the number. Maybe you live by one of Illinois' major rivers. Are you worried about how climate change might affect your life in the future? Or maybe you depend on a river for your livelihood. Do you think it's time to revamp the infrastructure of Illinois' waterways? Or maybe you just have a question for our guest. 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. So we'll dive into the book in a moment, but first, in the acknowledgments, you write about a trip that inspired this book. You were in a 16-foot aluminum boat going down the Ohio River, camping on the banks, and on your last day, something happened close to Olmsted and Cairo, Illinois. Can you share that story?
Certainly. So our outboard motor broke down. My friend and I, you know, we were just sort of putting down the last few miles of the Ohio River, and the motor broke down right by this sort of old decrepit concrete. We thought it was like a dock or something, and there was nobody around. So we tied up and we ran up these stairs, found a guy polishing a motorcycle who turned out to be an employee at this facility, which turned out to be lock and dam number 53 on the Ohio River, which is, well, at that time was the last lock and dam on the Ohio, because Olmsted, this, you know, gigantic mega dam, wasn't yet completed. And so the lock worker there didn't like the idea of us floating with a faulty motor down past this massive construction site with all these cranes and barges. And so he said we should stay the night. And he called the lock master, Randy Robertson, asked if it was okay. Randy said yes. And so, you know, I got to have a terrific, but it was probably, you know, 20 hours hanging out at the lock and dam watching just how they did things. And I was astonished. I mean, this place was built in 1928. And very little had changed since 28. You know, the concrete, the metal was pretty much all from 28. This steam-powered crane from 1937 that they used to raise the dam. So the dam was made of these panels that would lay on the river bottom and then would be raised by hand using the steam-powered crane. So I think when I saw the lock worker named Mike Burton fire up this boiler, this jet of flame, this giant tub of water, you know, I'd read about steamboats in the Mississippi and Mark Twain, and to see a steam boiler, you know, fire up with this whoosh like a jet engine, I think that's the moment that I was just hooked. Like I had seen a world, and I knew there was so much to this that I didn't know about, and I didn't think other people knew about it. I think from that moment on, I was obsessed, and I didn't know yet how this could be a news story, how it could be a book. Any of those questions hadn't been answered yet, but I had gotten a glimpse into this world.
Yeah, stepping back in time, it sounds like, almost. Well, so let's talk about it. You mentioned that was 53, but you spend a fair amount of time on Lock and Dam 52 as well, which I gather is right before 53 in the numbering sequence of how these things go. Can you talk? You call it the most decrepit lock and dam, and also the choke point of the nation. Can you talk about what you mean by that?
Right, and so it turns out that 52 is really where the sort of pressure comes down, because 53 isn't in operation as much. So the most of my reporting ended up focusing on 52, just a bit upstream. And so it turned out that it was the most important lock and dam in terms of commerce. The most tonnage passed, you know, passed by this point. I think it was 80 million tons in 2018. But it was also far and away the most decrepit lock and dam, although the Illinois River, I think, is runner up for decrepitude. And those lock and dams are still operational. So we can talk about that if you want to. But these ones on the Ohio, I mean, you know, just concrete coming off in chunks, metal with holes in it, you know, hydraulic fluid leaking, the pieces of the dam just coming off basically in people's hands as they tried to raise this dam. And so I was able to be there one fall in 2018 as Luther Helland, he was the lock master there, and his crew were raising the dam. You know, the water falls, so you have to raise the dam to hold back the water. And, you know, one thing that really struck me is you can read about aging infrastructure. You can find, you know, concrete structures with holes in them all over the place. But one thing I hadn't understood is the pressure it puts on individuals, just the people whose job it is to manage these things. And they really were feeling squeezed. I mean, because they were being asked to do an impossible task. You know, they were being asked to hold back the river with this structure that was just really not up to the job. And the human toll of that, I guess, the anxiety, the frustration, I think that was really, you know, something I hadn't heard much about before.
Wow, that's fascinating. We need to take a break. Let me remind listeners, we're talking with Tyler Kelly. He's the author of the new book, Holding Back the River, The Struggle Against Nature on America's Waterways. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. We're going to continue our conversation on rivers, particularly those in and around Illinois. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking with Tyler J. Kelly, author of the new book, Holding Back the River, The Struggle Against Nature on America's Waterways. We want to hear from you, listeners. 800-222-9455 is the number, especially if you live by a river or maybe your livelihood depends on Illinois rivers. If you're worried about how climate change might affect your life or livelihood, 800-222-9455. Or if you just have a question for our guest, 800-222-9455. So we were talking before the break about some of the Lock and Dam 52, which is decrepit, as you described it. It's also critical, this last stretch of the river between Caro and Metropolis, Illinois, is the most critical stretch of water in the American interior. Can you talk about what would happen if there were to be a failure of the river freight system? I mean, I'm thinking back, a lot of people will be familiar with what happened to the Suez Canal in March. I mean, is there a, you know, admittedly smaller scale, but, or maybe not smaller scale, what would happen if there were a sort of a breakdown on that stretch of the Ohio in southern Illinois?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's been no comprehensive study of that, but let's see. So the easiest thing to talk about is grain, because grain is the major commodity, probably number one, moving at least on the Mississippi. And so there have been studies looking at not even if the lock and dam system were to go down, but what if it just continues to become less efficient? And so in the United States, farmers are at a tremendous advantage because they can move their grain from a farm onto a waterway very rapidly. So they don't have to truck it that far. They don't have to move it great distances until they can get it on the water. And once they can get it on the water, it can move so cheaply, really, from, you know, any spot on Illinois on the river to a port in China. China's the largest grain buyer. But what's happening is in Brazil, which is the biggest number two grain producer, they are, with the help of China, improving their river infrastructure, improving their grain elevators, improving efficiency on their navigation system. Obviously, Brazil has a bunch of massive rivers, right? And so if the lock and dams in the United States don't begin to operate or can operate more efficiently, if we don't invest more so they can become more efficient and stop becoming less efficient, which is what's happening now. The trend is downward towards less efficiency. By 2045, this USDA study found Brazil's soybeans would become cheaper than the soybeans in the United States. And so, you know, then there'd be no reason for anyone to buy American soybeans anymore, you know, less reason. And so this study from USDA looked at how that would ripple across all these different sectors of the economy. So, you know, they estimate emissions go up because, again, shipping by water is the most fuel efficient way to ship anything. Fatalities would go up because there are fewer deaths per ton per mile on the waterways than anywhere else. And, you know, not to mention the impact to the grain producing heartland of the United States. So, you know, farmers would have to put their products on rail and they would be paid, you know, less for them. And so a lot of farm ground would go out of production. Small town economies would be, you know, damaged, as you can all imagine. You know, it'd be a substantial negative impact to the center of the country.
So now one of the things that's been done to try and stave off that particular potential problem is in Olmsted, Illinois, in Pulaski County. There's a new dam. It's called the Olmsted Locks and Dam. Again, on the Ohio River, it's intended to replace dam numbers 52 and 53. This project, as you report, began in 1996. It wasn't finished until 2018. $3 billion. Can you talk about why the project took so long, why it was so expensive? What went wrong?
Yeah, and it was actually authorized by Congress in 1988. So the project originates that long ago. So there are several factors, but incremental funding is one. Congress allocates funding for these projects each time they do a water resources bill, which I think tends to be every 2 years or so. And so sometimes they would give the project no money, and sometimes they would give it a bunch of money. And it's really hard, as anyone who's ever worked in construction knows, to all of a sudden have a project running and then realize next year you don't have any money. You lay your people off, you know, you put your equipment to sleep, you shut stuff down, and it costs a lot more to start and stop a project like that. So incremental funding from Congress is one huge problem. Another big problem, I think, is, and the Government Accountability Office agrees with this, is this kind of obsession with innovation that was going around when Olmsted was really being planned in the late 90s, early 2000s. And they really wanted to do something innovative. And so they picked this construction method called in the wet, where they would create a hollow shell, a piece of the dam on land, float it over the river, these giant cranes and catamaran barges the size of a 10-story building, drop this shell into the Ohio River onto the bottom, and then pump it full of concrete with a pipe and a little thin pipe pumping this thing with concrete. So this construction method called in the wet had really never been attempted before at this kind of scale and in an environment that was so dynamic as the Ohio River, which can rise and fall 50 feet in a season. So I think many people would agree that in the wet was a mistake, and it took way too long, cost way too much, and the tried and true method of construction called cofferdams, where you basically just build a wall, pump the water out, construct the thing in the dry, you know, there would have been downsides, but I think it would have been much more predictable and much faster. Yeah. And probably cheaper to build.
Yeah. The traditional methods over the innovation. You mentioned before that, though, funding, and I'm glad you did, because, you know, right now we are hearing a lot of discussion about potential infrastructure bill out of Washington. President Biden has proposed $2.3 trillion in his package. What does the Olmsted example say about America's ability, I wonder, to execute these massive infrastructure projects? And do you see anything in the current sort of infrastructure bill that might address some of the issues that you've been writing about?
I mean, I think to date, you know, Biden's American Jobs Plan is really quite vague on the details. It's just a proposal, and it proposes to do so much far beyond the definitions of traditional infrastructure that, you know, what it says about waterways, which are usually the last piece of infrastructure to get discussed or get attention or funding, is very minimal. So I think, you know, it's too early to say what the Biden plan might do on the waterways. But I think if there is a way for Congress to fund projects in their totality and say, we're gonna set aside, you know, I think the original estimate for Olmsted was $775 million, and that was probably in 88 or a little bit later. If they can say, we're gonna allocate this money right now and you can build this project all in one shot instead of waiting to see if you can fund it bit by bit by bit. And I'm not an economist. I can't I can't tell you how this would be done, but that I think that would be far, far more beneficial for everybody involved to fund a project that way.
Yeah. Let me take a moment to remind listeners, if you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Tyler Kelly, the author of Holding Back the River, The Struggle Against Nature on America's Waterways. Let's move now from the Ohio River to the Mississippi. You spent time in a number of Illinois cities there, the Cairo, Olive Branch, Thebes, a lot of other Midwestern cities along the Mississippi floodplain. What did you find in those places, particularly about the levees and whether or not they're prepared to handle flooding?
I think, you know, the first thing I found, you know, me coming from, you know, outside of this region, that I had no idea how much development there was in the floodplain, how many towns, factories, farms relied on these levees. Meaning, you know, if not for a levee, which is, you know, these low earthen walls, these places would be flooded regularly, you know, would be unusable, uninhabitable, undevelopable. So just the reliance on these levees was really striking for me. And then, you know, you start to talk about, well, you know, what condition are the levees in? And, you know, there's sort of a curious, it's just sort of a fluke of history, but below Cairo on the Mississippi, there's a really terrific levee system called the Mississippi River and Tributaries Project, which was constructed as a result of the flood of 1927, the worst, pretty much the worst flood ever in the United States. But and that system does stretch up to, I think, Cape Girardeau, which is Missouri across the river. But so nobody in Illinois, except for Cairo, I think Cairo is the lowest, probably the end of that system. So Cairo has really good levees that are, you know, basically guaranteed by the Corps of Engineers. And so if there's any threat to the Cairo system, the Corps of Engineers will send people up from Memphis and they will, you know, flood fight on that levee, which means putting, you know, rings around sand boils, which is when the river sort of works its way underneath the levee and starts to geyser up in the land side. So they will fight for that levee, and they have spent a lot of money on that levee and are sort of like, think of a military organization. They are committed. It is like their mission to not let the Cairo levee fail. But on the other hand, just upstream from there, it's still in Randolph County, you have the Len Small Levee District, which is a private levee. And so private, meaning the government has very little interest in this levee. That levee has been allowed to fail many times. I think you could, I've counted 93, 2016, 2018, I think, and it never was rebuilt after 2018. So that levee's gone. And the farmland, last time I was there, you know, looked like the Sahara Desert, just covered in piles of sand, ripped apart by the scour of the river, because there's a bend there and the river wants to go straight, you know, taking the shortcut across the bend. So that levee, because it's not enrolled in this federal system, basically that area has become a de facto floodway. It's being allowed to fail, it's being allowed to flood, and that takes pressure off of other levees in the area. So it's sort of this tremendous inequality, really, when it comes to flood protection and who gets what flood protection where. And the way it seems to me is there's, because these things are kind of set in stone, so to speak, because of they've been this way for so long, there's really no way for anyone to change. There's no fresh look at, you know, what should we protect with the levee? How strong should the levee be? With what frequency should this land be allowed to flood? No one's looking at things afresh. It's just this sort of piecemeal system comprised of, you know, inertia and just whoever was able to get, you know, what they could get when the getting was good. And so I don't think that that's sort of the best system or, you know, the system that serves the greater good necessarily. And so, you know, I think that's something that many residents of Illinois probably are concerned about.
Yeah. And you have, and there's anecdotes in the book that we don't have time to recount here, but, you know, farmers have to give up their land. They basically walk away from their lives because of some of these problems that they're experiencing. You know, can you talk just in the couple of minutes we have remaining about climate change, how it's affecting America's waterways and particularly our ability to control the water with dams and levees and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, to put simply, there's more rain, right? There's more snow, there's more precipitation. So the rivers are higher more often, you know, breaking records higher. And so the system that's on the ground now isn't up to it. The system that's on the ground now, you know, again, originates in the 1920s through the 1950s. It, I think, reflects a set of assumptions, again, as I was saying a moment ago, sort of assumptions about society, about what we value, and assumptions about the climate that are outdated. And so, you know, I think there are really smart people at the Corps of Engineers, and you could build a system that could protect what we want to protect against, protect it from, you know, the rising rivers brought on by climate change, but it's not being done. And again, I think it requires someone to say, let's look at this again. Let's give this a fresh look. Let's have this conversation about what we want to protect and how much we're willing to spend to protect it. And so it's not that protection can't be achieved, but it's not going to look the way it looks now. You know, I think we are going to have to retreat from some areas. We are going to have to let some areas flood once in a while. And I think that could be okay if it was sort of packaged right and presented in the right way to the American people.
Just a few sentences. What final question? What do you hope people take away from reading your book?
I guess I hope people start to ask their leaders these same questions. That we have, you know, we've bent these rivers to our will. We've gotten a lot of benefit out of it. We've paid a lot of costs. We've paid a lot for it. We've given up a lot. And, you know, I think we need to reassess that equation.
Tyler J. Kelly is the author of Holding Back the River, The Struggle Against Nature on America's Waterways. Tyler, thanks so much for being with us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
And that is all the time we have for today. Before we go, I do want to urge you to join our texting group, Text the 21st. We do hear interesting things from listeners. It informs our coverage. You can join by texting the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Again, send the word TALK to 217-803-0730. You can find more information in that number again on our website, 21stshow.org, where you can also find links to our podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Do sign up for that at 21stshow.org. Our program is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Chantel Vaca is our engagement producer. Our interns are Zainab Qureshi and Brielle Scullark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.